Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is the groundbreaking political thinker, writer, and activist, Zila Eisenstein. Eisenstein is a professor emerita of political theory at Ithaca College. She is the author of more than a dozen books, including Man-Made Breast Cancers, The Audacity of Races and Genders, The Female Body and the Law, as well as Against Empire. Her new book is called Abolitionist Socialist Feminism, Radicalizing the New Revolution. It was published this year by Monthly Review Press. And welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be back.
Tell us what abolitionist socialist feminism encompasses. People have asked me that when I gave them the title of your book. What does that mean?
Well, it means something, which I'll say, but, you know, of course, my publisher didn't love the title either, but I was totally committed to it on the basis that it's really why I wrote this book. I mean, in some ways, abolitionist socialist feminism is to argue that socialist feminism today has to have as its priority the destruction and reconstruction beyond white supremacy. And although I have a history of being an activist and a writer of socialist feminism for more than four decades, this book had a clarity to me that given what has been happening in the last decade in this country, that as a socialist feminist, my priority as a white woman has to be against white supremacy. So most often today, the term abolitionist is thought of in terms of abolishing the prison system and the whole carceral structure that necessitates a prison system. But my meaning is bigger than that, in that, or adjacent to it, either way, which would argue that we must abolish white supremacist misogyny if we are to live in a free country, free world, free society.
Yeah, and you've been talking about a lot of these issues for many, many decades. As you said, do you see things getting better or worse right now?
Well, you know, that's just a really tricky question. Better in what way? Better for whom? There's been a huge amount of change, and in other work that I've done, I say everything has changed, nothing has changed, too much has changed, not enough has changed. So if you look at the violence towards black women in this country right now, to the recent police killings of two completely innocent black women, one who was just in her home, you would definitely, if you're walking around in this country in a black woman's body, I doubt you'd feel as though things have gotten better. But have things changed enormously? And are the configurations of racism and misogyny and economic inequality different? Yes, they are. At certain sites, are they easier to manage? Yes. At other sites, they're more difficult. The incredibly egregious economic inequality, poverty, and suffering right now, I think that's at a peak, at least in terms of, last half century.
I sense it too, especially the economic inequality. It's beyond belief. You know, you talk a little bit about personal issues in this book, and you mentioned being brought up in a communist household. Tell us about that. How did that affect your activism?
Well, it just affected everything about who I am, and I share just little bits of that in this book. But, you know, this book is enormously personal. I open the book that way. And on some level, I really do say that it's in some ways, just a manifesto as I have turned 70, what did I feel was not done well enough yet in my own writing? And that's what this is. But in some ways, there's nothing new in this book, and everything is new, you know, both ways, because I'm trying to deal with the particulars of this moment. But having been, I had three sisters, the four of us, we were each other's comrades. Life was very difficult growing up through the 50s, the incredible anti-communism in this country. My parents were very much punished, lost jobs all the time. We were quite poor and moved. I never lived anywhere longer than 2 years. Ithaca, New York is the only place I've lived longer than 2 years.
What a remarkable story that is. Did you understand early on why people were so afraid of communism?
Well, yeah. I mean, our parents were pretty, we were, you live in the politics of that moment. So for us, but, you know, of course, my parents were different, you know, being older than us, but my sisters, we grew up in the civil rights movement, and it was really the Communist Party that was the most committed to integration at that time, that language. And so our private lives were completely about activism in terms of breaking open the segregated world that existed at that time. So activism, though, wasn't this kind of different thing. It was just everyday life.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't have any choice about it. And my father, both of my parents were just brilliant, committed, loving people. But my father was the more difficult one, and he was unrelenting. So if we ever asked for any kind of a day off, you know, just leave us alone. He would say to us, you know, if you had a black skin, you don't get a day off. You know, so there was just no barter at all. But today, do I feel as though the way that I can live honestly in terms of being an anti-racist and that I know exactly what that demands of me? It is because of my parents that I know.
I can imagine. Now, you actually came to full adulthood in the 70s and you got involved in the black socialist movement, anti-racism movement, even the feminist movement as well. To tell us about that. It was almost a segue from the life with your parents.
Well, it was that feminism became an integral part of who I was, and who I was a socialist, communist, whatever. So, but of course, other people who would argue, you know, certain ways with their parents in my household, my argument was that feminism was not derivative. Feminism was not a secondary struggle, that it had to be a completely equal partner in the struggle for socialism. And much of my earliest work, both as a graduate student, my dissertation, my writing, my activism in the women's movement, either the feminists thought I was too socialist or the socialists thought I was too feminist. And I don't know, keeping me always in that kind of precarious position, I think kept me intellectually healthy and politically honest.
You don't think it cornered you, though, to have those labels attached to you, and even when you were sometimes uncomfortable?
No, I don't. I do think sometimes that just has to do with when we were almost too young to understand what was happening to us.
Yeah.
My parents made us so calm with the lack of safety that was part of our life. And courageous. I just don't know. So I never have felt uncomfortable with the tensions. And I think that has served me very well in the work that I do with some of my beloved black feminist colleagues and friends, that I'm never frightened to be fully honest, and then I can be trusted.
Yeah.
So,
no, I understand that too, for sure. I mean, just read a few of your books, and we know that. You know, you say in this book that you are uneasy and doubtful, and equally passionate that radically progressive people can transform the world. How now?
Well, you know, of course, when I was young, I thought that, you know, that it would have already happened.
I understand
and
that.
And now what I understand, sadly, is the enormous ongoing struggle that it is to really move towards social justice. But at the same time, there just is not a clear path. So if you think about the opening of all kinds of gender borders, sexual borders, the ability for transgender, non-binary people to have space, not to say that that does not still, that that is not still a troubled site to inhabit.
Yeah, yeah.
But there is a naming of it, just like sexual harassment. Until it was named in 1971 legally, it didn't exist, in quotes, okay?
I understand that. Susan Brown Miller's book was the one that turned a lot of us onto sexual harassment, rape.
Right, okay. Of course, she's now, you know, many years later, has been really critiqued for some of the racism of her particular way of articulating it. But I express an incredible conundrum, both in the book, in my life, in my work, and that is that I think it is amazing the way we open new possibilities all the time through the struggle and camaraderie that we try to create.
And
at the same time, so much of the struggle is as a result of very punitive and controlling moments. And I do think that, you know, I wrote a lot and worked a bunch about, you know, the contradictions of democracy. Mm. And some of my work has been about neoliberal democracy and how it's not democratic. But then at one point I did say, and this is almost a decade ago, that neoliberal democracy has died in the United States, and we are a fascistic democracy. Now, there is, you know, those are totally contradictory terms, and yet not.
Exactly. You know? I mean, all you have to do is wander through the culture and talk to anybody who's not white.
Yeah. But also the idea that if we're waiting for fascism to look like Nazi Germany, it's not going to. It is a brilliant system that exists here. And it uses a lot of democratic forms. This is kind of post-book, but very much about the work I'm doing. The whole world is exploding at the moment.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Whether it's Lebanon or Chile or Hong Kong, millions of people in the street. Argentina, the women were in the streets the minute abortion was said to be no longer legal, right? So in the United States, we are not millions in the street. All right. And so I'm beginning to, is that because we think we're democratic still? So that we're, you know, waiting for the impeachment as opposed to in Lebanon, they said, get the f*** out of here. Right.
Yeah, yeah. But you know what? I think a lot of people do think this is a calm democracy.
Yeah,
they do not see the shadows in between the lines. So it's a passive culture right now in some ways.
Well, I guess if I'm going to share here, you know, democracy does not work. It does not work. It's a lie.
So you're talking about for the general population, it does work for some people, straight white men, perhaps?
Yeah, but that's not democracy.
That's not democracy.
Okay. So democracy, ever since the beginning, it was a critique in this country. First, we had to make it so that, you know, black people could vote, own property. All right, then women, et cetera. So it's just been a work in progress.
Yes.
I think it's no longer, that should not be the work in progress.
You asked the question, what would abolishing white supremacy look like in this country, especially? Let's talk about that, because I can't picture it at all in this racist culture that seems to be getting worse.
Well, again, I mean, I'm not a utopian. I don't have, like, it's out of the actual struggles. So what do I think it looks like? Well, already, just the way that some of the real argument about decarceration and putting prisons in the limelight as a horrific sight in this country, or the cages that thousands of children are in.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
obscene.
So
yep.
In that struggle, if we can mobilize further and further, or mobilize further to save the planet, you know, the idea that if we don't save the planet, nothing else really matters. But my point here is the environmental struggle around climate crisis, you know, that crisis is also a crisis of white supremacy. And so that as the world has become more global, white supremacy on some level has become a lie. All you have to do is look at the population statistics in Europe, in the United States. The truth now is, although whites have always been a minority on the globe, it's becoming, as people have begun to travel and move, whether in refugee status or not, right, or migrant.
Yeah.
So the point here is that there already is a shifting that feels liberatory to plenty of people of color. And if you're an anti-racist white person, you already begin to see the possibilities.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Zila Eisenstein. She is a groundbreaking political thinker as well as a writer. And we're talking about her new book, Abolitionist Socialist Feminism, Radicalizing the New Revolution. You know, you ask a question that we need to grapple with for 2020. Why did white women not vote against a racist misogynist in chief like Trump? Do you have an answer to that question? Because it seems to me that we're working into another phase where that could happen again.
Well, again, I think that many white women who voted for Trump were voting for their status as white. And they were willing to, I mean, many of them don't get a whole hell of a lot of status from misogyny. You know, many of them who suffer it in different ways. So the point here is, of course, trying to get white women. At the end of the book, I say, look, whatever, you know, if you can't figure this out, just vote like black women, you know, let them lead here, because their voting has just been stellar, you
Absolutely.
Know, whether it was
yeah.
for Obama or Hillary Clinton, although I was not a supporter of hers, I didn't vote for her. But just on this issue of the way that 2020 might evolve, I mean, my own feeling pretty deeply is to stop worrying about what white people are going to do in this election, whether it's your so-called white working class man or white women who are just entrenched in their whiteness. There are so many new voters, new possible voters. I think all the energy should be around really trying to limit the suppression of the vote, limit any kind of gerrymandering that allows for.
But it seems like we've already lost some of that.
Well, we have
you know
lost,
what I mean?
but I just think that, again, we just may have to give it up, you know? The Electoral College is a racist institution.
Absolutely.
The whole issue around representation in this country is pretty much a lie in terms of suppression and new levels of it. So if our voting isn't, you know, acceptable, I mean, meaning that it doesn't really reflect the new consciousness of our public.
Yes, and the new configuration of the minorities.
Yes, and the new configurations. If it doesn't, then we become an illegitimate society. And then that has a whole other set of rules and regulations. But all I'm saying is at this particular moment, I mean, I think everything is up for grabs yet.
Yeah, I agree. Yep.
In terms of Bernie Sanders, in terms of Elizabeth Warren, and I mean, I do have some real serious questions that I don't know what the answers are to when it comes to this particular election.
Yeah, it's a crapshoot for real. Now, you say that criminal law is deeply embedded in a white mind framework. Tell us about that, because that affects the general culture.
Or the general culture affects law. I mean, it goes both ways.
Yeah, exactly,
right?
Exactly.
I'm saying the white mind or the white vision, what you see, what gets silenced, what. So the point is, law by definition, the imagery that all laws emanate from is from the white male body.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's why pregnancy and abortion, et cetera, you can't really deal with it legally you know, in terms of the Constitution, there are no mention of the particulars here. Of course, the same in terms of what the history of chattel slavery, how that absolutely laws were put in place to try to ameliorate some of the change that was going to happen as a result of the end of slavery. That's what Jim Crow was. It was a reaction to just ameliorate the white interests. So I would think that with really an end to white supremacy, you know, you would have
major breakthroughs in some ways. Yeah. Although, you know, that's not going to happen very soon. To tell us what you think about the Me Too movement. How has that changed the culture and the thinking in this country?
Well, the Me Too, then I discuss it in the book. I mean, I think it was a really important development. I mean, Tarana Burke, of course, a decade earlier was utilizing that phrase and definitely the politics of it with the young black girls that she worked with who had been sexually abused. I think what was amazing about the Me Too movement, even though it had real significant limits to it, was it mobilized new voices and new consciousness about the kind of regularity of sexual abuse in everyday life.
Yeah, yeah.
And on kind of every level, the different voices of Me Too, it came from domestic workers, it came from waitresses, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
it initially was articulated by women in the movie industry and...
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those movements that I dreamed of as an activist, that something like this would become a groundswell of many different women, many different races. I find it actually quite fascinating that it happened now or recently. You know, one of the things that you talk about in your book is that you hope that all these organizations and groups and political philosophies will create coalitions together in order to create this new world. To tell us how that might happen. How is it going to transect?
Well, it seems to me that if you really recognize that each individual, you know, has multiple identities and multiple sites that it interacts with structures of power. So if you are looking at a person and you're thinking about the involvements that they might have, let's say, as a woman of color in the middle class or in the working class, and let's say located in the South here, and you're involved in groups, the different groups that you'll be involved in crisscross, they're different. They have different focus, but they also have crossover that allows for a real coalescing of interests.
And it has to do with the people involved.
Yeah, well, it does, but it also has to do with the understanding that in order to really deal with environmental crisis, that you also have to deal with the poverty of people who, because the poor, of course, are hurt the most in environmental crises and the quickest. So if there is a consciousness of that, then you mobilize with it. But one of the major themes of the work that I'm doing even right now is it does seem extraordinary to me how slow progressives are, for sure, not to mention other political people, to see the way that misogyny is either implicit or explicit in whatever other malformation there is, so that there's never been racism without misogyny.
Absolutely.
You know? So the idea, I go through just very different sites in the book, the idea that the Pope is the most radical Pope ever, and I'm thinking, what are you talking about? Yeah. You know, he doesn't believe in abortion. He says he, you know, they say he's egalitarian and he's against poverty. Well, one of the major reasons for poverty among women is when they can't control their reproduction.
Yes.
So the different locations we go to, the idea right now even that people will give a kind of political resonance to the notion and recognition that Trump is a racist, but not that he is a rapist.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, my point is that he's both. I'm not saying one is more important than the other.
Yeah.
But what is the problem with bothness and all?
But I still think it has to do with women's place in society. That women's issues are not taken seriously. Women's politics is still considered second grade.
But this isn't about just women here. This
is about
really sexual control and power.
Yes.
So the use of sexual violence, as I say in the book, I think sexual violence is the glue of just about every society. But why does it never get political recognition and theorization and therefore action? So when Bernie Sanders the other day said, "You vote for me and I will make sure that all economic injustice is ended." I mean, what's so hard about saying, "You vote for me and my commitment is to end sexual violence"? Have we even heard anyone come near that issue? No.
Yeah, yeah.
Has there been a question in one of the debates? No.
So do you think the Me Too movement has galvanized some people and brought some of these issues into the fore?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it's really...
So how do we build on that?
Exactly. You build on it. The purpose of my argument and the work that I'm doing is the way you build on it is you connect it to its other struggles. Don't isolate it as a singular issue, but don't isolate racism either.
Yeah, yeah. We only have a couple minutes left.
Sure.
Tell me how you think this philosophy that you have laid out for us in your book, how can that manifest to everyday people in their everyday lives?
Well, again, I mean, everyday people in their everyday lives. I mean, I don't know if you're saying, like, in what they do every day as opposed to... everyday people understood that they belong in the streets right now. I wish that everyday people would look at the news and say, Hong Kong has been out there, what is it, 12 weeks, 14 weeks?
Yes.
Where are we? Okay? So, you know, I wish we'd all kind of shut up about Trump. That's all the news we're getting, as the rest of the world is kind of beginning to fight against the fascism, the new fascisms across this globe.
Yeah, yeah.
But do I believe that everyday people, that's who I believe in.
Yeah, yeah.
The everyday people.
But do you also believe that an awakening needs to happen?
Well, I think the awakening is happening. I just think that our system here has been incredibly effective and brilliant, and that most people think that they don't make a difference.
Thank you so much, Zila Eisenstein.
You are very welcome.
It was a pleasure talking to you.
I've
been talking to Zila Eisenstein. Her book is Abolitionist Socialist Feminism, Radicalizing the Next Revolution. Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.